All right, we are live. Hello, everyone. We are here with another episode with Catherine Checkdown. We're going to be discussing another one of her articles on Israel Times. Israel Times, right? Yes.
The
Times of Israel. I should have that link. I should post a link to it. I'll post a link into it in a live chat once you're talking. But this one was about some infighting within the Iranian regime, about different sections in the Iranian regime taking positions against some other ones, and all of that happening amidst all these protests that are increasing in Iran. They're like, the distance between the protests are decreasing, they're becoming a lot more frequent. People were expecting the protests to become more and more, but then the whole pandemic happened and they stopped. So they were expecting that once the pandemic is over, for the protests to pick up, and now the pandemic is over, and they were right. The protests are picking up with a lot shorter distance between them. Like, it's just like protests all the time in Iran right now. Like, it's either, but in this environment, now we have a lot of infighting between different, and again, this is not between reformers and, you know, conservatives or like hardliners. This is within hardliners. So, which is a lot more significant than the fight between reformers and hardliners. So you had an article about that. And do you want to tell us a little bit about it? And what are your thoughts on it? So we could get like.
Yeah. So first of all, hey everyone. So I'm taking Susanna's spot right now. I'm actually happy about it. Sorry, Susanna. because. Do you know, amidst all these protests, and I get a little bit tired as well of, mainstream media, number one, not talking about it, or dismissing the importance of the protests, you know, kind of reducing it to, you know, this anger against, you know, price inflation and things like this. And I felt that mainstream was really missing the mark when it came to giving people a really solid understanding of what was going on in Iran. So obviously people are angry about, you know, food prices and all the rest of it. But it's a lot deeper than that. I mean, in terms of their rejection of the regime altogether in the Islamic Republic, and the fact that now it's cutting across, you know, all the echelons of society in Iran. So you have, for example, you know, lawyers, professors, you know, you have people working in various industries. So you have literally the entire society coming out, you know, as one to reject the regime. And that led to a very interesting political setup within the regime that I felt was important to talk about, because, again, very few people, I feel, have a good understanding of the Iranian psyche and what happens in Iran and what that means. And I had wind, you know, of what I'm talking about, you know, this kind of like little coup that certain people are talking about. Because look, the Islamic Republic, I know, is very much associated to, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei. And they feel that, you know, we had, you know, Khomeini, and then Ayatollah Khamenei was appointing as his successor, and that he is basically the regime. Now, he's rather old. I mean, he's 82, 83, something like this. People have alleged for years now that, you know, he's ill, that he's going to die soon. Regardless of the reality, the point is he's old and he will die. That's just, you know, how things work. And for many years, for about a decade now, you had people within the regime, the deep state, who have been planning various options and trying to figure out if that was to happen, what they would do. So they have a contingency plan, you know, in place. Now, because of the protest and the fact that there's been a very clear understanding now for about, again, a good 10 years, that the regime, the Islamic Republic, as we understand it today in its formulation, will have to come to an end by the very nature of this regime, meaning that it's literally feeding off its people's blood. It's not, you know, allowing for, you know, a share of, you know, natural resources. The money is very much concentrated into the, you know, the hands of a handful few. It's, you know, people are, you know, losing their buying power. So that means that, you know, their living situation and conditions is degrading, you know, year after year. Inflation is rising up. It's not a situation that you can, you know, you can keep for a very long time without having a massive revolution. They understand this. They're not stupid. So basically, there was this contingency plan that was set up years ago that actually I had discussion. People had discussion with me about it, trying to explain to me, you know, what it would mean on the ground, technically speaking, and the kind of steps that would need to be taken. Now, it's not like they were telling me we're going to get rid of Khamenei, but discussions were made telling me that the leadership, as it is not just a man but an office, and that this office needs to survive regardless of the man behind it. It's interesting. And, you know, as you know, I'm still talking to people in Iran who are, you know, in certain positions. So I do listen when they tell me things. And the thing that came to me was that, and I knew that to be true because, again, it was cutting, it was reminding me of the conversation that I had. And I knew that it was a very real plan that could be activated should they decide to. So you have basically three main, I would say, factions within the regime. You have the Raisi side, which is basically the leadership. You have, what's his name? Ahmadinejad. Yes. And you have also, you know, the whole clan of Rouhani, which are not really reformist, but they're kind of like a bit more liberal in the way that they look at things. And those people, for very, you know, different reason, feel that they need each other to survive. So they might not agree on everything, but they understand that should they want to have, you know, continuity and actually survive whatever is coming at them, and they understand that things are coming at them, they're going to have to, you know, stick together and survive together. Otherwise, that means the end of it all. And they were actually planning to overthrow, okay, is a big word, the regime, in the sense that what they wanted to do is basically precipitate the you know, the change of leadership, in that Khamenei would have to go.
And yes. So for people who might not know all these people, sorry, there's some echo. What you're describing is some mullahs turning on some other mullahs, so that in this chaos, the structure of the regime, at least if the people are removed, the structure of the regime stays in place and they get to survive this turmoil. Is that what you're saying?
Yes and no. Yes, they will keep. They want to keep the regime as it is in terms of, you know, its iteration. So the fact that it's controlling the people and using religion to do so. But what they want to do is they understand that as it is today, the institutions is not a viable solution long term. So they want to take it a step further. When Khomeini came up with the Islamic Revolution and the institution that you have, it wasn't meant to stay that way forever. They, you know, that was, you know, step one, and then there's step two and three. Now they want to get to step two, and step two would mean it's kind of a devolution of step one, in the sense that rather than have the Ayatollah, so the jurist, basically governing over, they want to keep the leadership as it is. So you still have an Ayatollah running the show, but the true power, the continuity of power, would not be within his hands, but rather within that of ISGC. So it would be more some kind of a militarized Islamic Republic. So you're kind of taking it.
So for people who don't know, IRGC is one of the two main armed forces in Iran, and the more mm-hmm. ideological one, you're saying there will be a transfer of power from the mullahs yes. to the military, to the armed forces.
Yes, so in terms of the executive of the country. So the leadership, okay. in terms of its legitimacy, its religious legitimacy, will still be there. But in essence, the executive power and everything else that he has in his hands, which is, you know, the judicial and the legislative, would be more within the hands of the RSGC as a unit, as opposed to just one man. That would allow for the Islamic Republic to be able to weather a lot more opposition and belligerence coming from the outside and from the inside than if you just leave it with one man, because one man could be removed. It's a lot more difficult to remove an entire institution. And this is where it gets interesting. When Khomeini came to power, as you know, Iran was a very classic kind of like nation state where you had, you know, military, judicial, you know, you have all the regular state institutions, right? Now, when he came to power, Khomeini understood that he could not rely on the military to protect not only him, but the people that he was ruling over. And that's why he created the ISGC. It was a militia that was meant to protect the leadership, so his person and his ideology, right? Now, the very structure that he created to protect him and his office is actually absorbing the power of the leadership, you know, to claim it for its own and to project it out onto the people.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting. There's like an evolution of the ideology that is moving away from the, you know, kind of the textual, the conception that Khomeini had of the, what the Islamic Revolution should look like. And right. then what, you know, the fact that they allowed RSGC to have so much power and to operate like a shadow state within the state of Iran and to absorb a lot more power, and in doing so, actually absorb the leadership itself. And now you can see it moving away.
My understanding is that Khomeini didn't want the armed forces, including RSGC, to be involved with politics at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
He wanted mm-hmm. them to be... And so the design that Khomeini has for IRGC was not something that would make them capable of all the things that they're doing today, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was Khomeini that opened their chains and yeah. released this monster upon Iran, because it was a win-win situation between Khomeini and IRGC. Mm-hmm. So when Khomeini came to power, he wasn't supposed to be this powerful. Rafsanjani made him the supreme leader with the understanding of you're just going to be a nobody and the supreme leader position is going to not have any executive power and it's going to be the president that will control everything. And I will specifically pick somebody like Khamenei, who everybody knows that does not have the religious credentials to be a supreme leader, as a way, as I pick the weakest possible candidate to make yeah. sure that I control everything. But yeah. the problem is that they put in the constitution that he's the supreme leader and he's the supreme leader of God, everything, including the armed mm-hmm. forces. And Khamenei just used all the weapons that he had to play his hand. And he went with the RGC like, hey, how about I make you bigger than you are and you make me exactly. bigger than I am. And they exactly. just removed Rafsanjani from the picture, right? But exactly. the problem is that RGC grew so fast that now they are the actual supreme leader. Like Khamenei is the supreme leader by name, IRGC mm-hmm. is the actual supreme leader.
But so, you have yeah, seen this play out. Like if you look back, for example, do you know the fact that someone like, you know, Soleimani, who was, you know, the commander of RSGC, you saw the way that he was, I mean, I know that, you know, on camera, they were all very friendly, you know, with Khamenei and everything, but you could tell that there was like a very strong kind of competition, even in popularity, because Soleimani, because of his military credential, bought himself a lot of popularity within, you know, Iran, with Iranians, where he was very well respected, a lot more than Khamenei, because Khamenei is viewed like someone who usurped, you know, his religious position, in that they don't believe that he's a true Ayatollah, that he's not a Marja. He just, you know, they kind of like fast-tracked his credential, but he hasn't earned it. He's not on the same level as, you say, Ayatollah Sistani, for example, who's really well respected amongst religious clerics. Khamenei can't claim to this position. So or I even, think it's quite...
Even people like Alam al-Huda, like from Khorasan, even from, like, Sistani is like really high up there, but even within Iran, there were so many available mm-hmm. candidates that were so much higher than him when it comes exactly. to religious credentials.
Yeah. So Khamenei is actually now has become a liability because of all those different things. And the very group, RSGC, that he actually helped emancipate and gave so much power to, is now coming to bite his hand and actually come to collect something that is, you know, making his son, Mujtaba Khamenei, like really, really angry, because he was trying to find a way to get the power transferred to him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not happening.
Yeah.
Because there's so many things that, I mean, religiously, he doesn't have a claim. There's so many, you know, various reasons to why that's not going to happen. And also the fact that those diehard Khomeinists, like people who do believe in Khomeini's like vision, you know, keep telling him that it was never meant to be passed on from father to son. You can't have that, because that's exactly why Khomeini came and criticized the Shah.
Yes, exactly.
So you can't replicate that. They know it. They understand it. So it's quite interesting. So you have those, those three factions, I call them the three horsemen, trying to reinvent the Islamic Republic, take it away from Khamenei.
Who's the three horsemen that you mentioned?
Well, you have Raisi, Rouhani's clan, basically, and Ahmadinejad.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong about this. I don't think Rouhani's clan and Ahmadinejad have any chance.
No. They're working together. They're working together. They understand that their respective survival is together. Mm. So it's not so much that they agree with one another, but they're willing to reinvent what the Islamic revolution would look like, without Khamenei, and willing to precipitate his fall.
Who do you think is going to be the next supreme leader?
Well, it could very well be Raisi.
Raisi?
Very well be. But it's not going to be the same setup that we had before. Is in true power again would not be with him. It's going to be more like a puppet thing. It's just going to be a title. And ISIS will be truly, in power. But if you look at what Raisi has done lately, I mean, ever since he took power, it's actually quite interesting because there's a lot of provinces that he actually replaced the governors. And normally you had, people within the political circles that were just appointed to this position. He changed that and appointed former ISGC commanders. So people with military background. And that is very telling as to like the kind of direction that, the Islamic revolution is taking.
But Raisi doesn't...
He's the first one to do that.
Raisi also doesn't have the religious credential.
No, he doesn't. It doesn't, but it doesn't matter because if you have the backing of ISGC, that could be fast track or bypassed.
But you know who has? Alam al Huda has, which is Raisi's father in law, and he already has a cult of fall personality. Like he is, like there's, I think there's three, right now, as things are, there are three candidates for the next supreme leader. Mujtaba Khamenei, which very low chances. Raisi, the best thing about Raisi is that he just does everything you tell him. So if you make him the supreme leader, the IRGC will get everything it wants because he's a follower, not a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But Alam al-Huda, the thing that he has going for them is that you could sell that to people because he already has a personality where people are worshiping him like a god. He has the religious credentials. But the problem with him is that he's not a follower. He's a leader. Right, so IRGC wouldn't want somebody like him that like wouldn't like would fight back. Like you wouldn't like you, they want a dog. They want a dog on a leash. They don't want another Khamenei.
That's the problem that they have right now. That's why you have. There's a lot of bickering. There's a lot of bickering. But do you know the interesting thing is that ever since I went to Iran, there was actually talk about moving the capital away from Tehran and relocating it to Mashhad. And I think that's very, very interesting. Because if you recall, Ahmadinejad came out a few years ago in an interview, and he was actually saying that Mashhad is the spiritual capital of Iran and the Shia Islamic world. And I was thinking that's such an interesting thing to say, because, see, this is the problem that I have with mainstream, is that a lot of the time you have people telling you things, but no one picks it up and no one pays attention. Everything I'm telling you is actually out there. They've said it before. So I'm literally just connecting dots, and I have a bit more context because of the conversation that I had. But it's all out there. People can research it and actually say like, okay, so there's been a theme running. They've actually been telling you what is it that they're trying to do, because I think they're sending feelers to the public to kind of gauge people's reaction to what is it that they say, to see whether or not people would push back and say, oh my God, no, we can never have that. And when people don't react, they kind of take this as almost some kind of popular consensus saying, okay, so people would not mind it too much. So maybe we could push that way further. Maybe we could just kind of move with this agenda. And I think it's interesting also if you look at the geography of Mashhad, because you're taking things, you're taking the conversation like further east, and it's in territory that is very well controlled by RSGC. So they would build themselves a little buffer against Iraq, for example.
But I don't know. Okay, so Khamenei just recently came up with a speech. Okay, I just think like the demographics of Iran has changed so much in the past 40 years. People are so dramatically moved away from Islam. Okay, more dramatically than anybody could have ever expected. Okay, so at a time that they are desperately grasping at viability or like any form of legitimacy, to make a religious push like that is kind of like a shooting yourself in the foot. Like I don't know if that's going to fly with the Iranian people. Like, I don't think they're going to let you do that. Like, we're like, we're sprinting.
No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I get what you're saying, but at the same time, understand that those people are cut off from society because they don't. I think they lost touch with reality in the sense that they believe so much. What is it that they say? That they're not even grasping that people are not buying. You know, they're not drinking the Kool-Aid anymore.
They can't be that stupid because how did they?
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. There's a profound disconnect, and there's such arrogance in terms of what the ideology means for them. Because it's for them, it's giving them everything that they want, power. They dismiss any form of opposition, always labeling it as, oh, those are like foreign powers talking. Those people have been sold out. They are traitors. They don't actually care. And they're actually quite willing to have a massive cleanse of Iran. And this is the danger, because if you see the language coming out of the regime right now and how the way that they address protesters, calling them foreign agents, how quickly people are being accused of being spies for, you know, this country or that country. The fact that, you know, they're trying to dehumanize them as well and say they're not even Iranians, if they're speaking against, you know, the Islamic Republic. It tells you that there's a profound desire to go around and literally cleanse the country of all opposition by violent means. And it's not the first time that, you know, they have done so, by the way. A lot of the time, whenever they're trying to crack down on opposition, they tend to be calling out, you know, their militia I'm talking about the outside militias, as in like, you know, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, whatever, to come and do the dirty work in Iran, to shoot people. They're not even using their own. So it has been done before. I think
at least 80% of Iranian people are against them, so that's not something you could just like violently get rid of.
Oh, but they think so. That's the thing. There's such disdain for any form of democratic discourse that they don't accept opposition, and they are willing to get rid of you. And they think that making examples out of enough people will quiet everyone else. It's a fascist ideology. It's a fascist mindset. They don't care. They think that, you know, whatever, you know, they're gonna be so harsh and violent on people that they will eventually, you know, shut up and go home and, you know, acquiesce to whatever the regime tells them.
It's hard for me to believe that they're this out of touch with Iranian people, given that against all odds, they managed to survive for 43 years. You know what I mean? Like, they must have some know-how and some understanding of how to do clever politics. If they have like this, no?
clever politics. Look, listen. Do you remember when Ahmadinejad went to the UN General Assembly and literally talked about, you know, how his people were waiting for Mahdi, and that he believed that, you know, foreign powers were actually chasing Mahdi to try to assassinate him? He said in an interview, and it's in my article, that he believed to be God's representative on Earth, and that his duty was to Mahdi.
Is it not possible to be religiously insane but politically clever at the same time?
Not in that case. No, because I think you're crazy. I think that ultimately crazy will take over. They're so out of touch. For 40 years they lived in a bubble. So even though, you know, they with the people, I mean, they live in Iran, obviously. I don't think they understand what is actually going on in people's head. They're so indoctrinated to their views. And they, like, you know, they live in this echo chamber where everyone is always keep saying the same thing. Even if they don't believe it, they keep saying it. So they don't understand that, you know, first of all, true power is always with the people. It's never with the leadership. The people have to give, to acquiesce to the leadership in order for the leadership to exercise power. Power is given willingly. You can't force it. There will be a point where you reach critical mass and then you go. It has been, I mean, history shows you that. Even the Tsar in Russia was, you know, deposed. And this is like a big thing to do in a country like Russia. But it was made possible. The same thing with the French Revolution. The things happen. They were profoundly out of touch too. They did not realize, because again, there's an arrogance there where they think that, oh, people don't matter. Yes, they do, because you exist because of them. If enough people are against you, that's it, you're done.
Well, it's actually, okay, so in support of what you're saying, Khamenei just recently, very recently, I think yesterday, had a speech where he said that the people of Iran are more Islamic today than the beginning of the revolution. That sure. they are more in support of the regime right now than they were 40 years ago.
There you go.
I don't understand. Like, is he insane or is he lying? It can't, like, it's one of these two. Like,
there's two things. Either he has people around him, that's possible, who keep feeding him these lies. And look, I was there. Every time that, you know, I was asking the question, but what about, you know, these people are saying this and what about this? They're like, no, this is a foreign plot. It's not true. It doesn't exist. I was thinking, do you actually believe your bullshit? Some people, I think, really believe that everything negative coming out of the people is a plot from foreign, you know, powers, and therefore it's not true. It's not a reflection of reality. And then you have the others who, for the sake of their own personal advancement and financial gain, will tell the leadership whatever it needs to hear in order to, you know, appear to be such loyal supporter of it. So they shield him from any form of criticism. They don't look to the point where I know for a fact that they were redacting some of the, you know, when they were handing Khamenei, for example, statements or, you know, studies about the economy, about whatever. They were flat out lying to him.
How do you know?
So I'll give you an example. Say if they were to give him, because I know of this one, there was a report that was basically created on Yemen to give, because the leadership wanted to know where the Houthi were, like, you know, what was the situation in Yemen politically, religiously, ideologically, like where they were, you know, in terms of Iran's Islamic Republic, whether they were for it, against it, like what was the situation, okay? There was two sets of reports that were actually written on that. So you had the first one that went straight to RSGC, okay, that was more reflective of the reality, and the second one that went for the leaderships. And it was a flat-out lie. They redacted everything because they were so scared that if they were to tell him the truth, he would actually blame the messenger and say, you're being disloyal to me and my leadership and how awesome I am. So they got so scared of that they redacted it.
Where did you see this?
Oh, they told me about it. I didn't see the report. They just told me about it.
The Iranian officials told you while you were in Iran?
Well, the people actually in charge of doing that report. They were telling me that they had to redact a lot of it. Yeah.
The people that were in charge of the report told you. Okay.
Yeah. And the conversation came about this way because, you know, they were asking me about my work with the Security Council on Yemen. And they were asking me, did you tell the truth? And I was like, well, you have to, because you have to back everything that you say with, you know, hard data and something that is verifiable. So you can't make up a story. You can't say, you know, this happened when it didn't, because they asked to see it. So I said, the only thing that you can kind of, where you have a bit more, I think, freedom is that in your interpretation of facts. So you could, you know, run different scenarios too, but it's still based on reality. You can't lie or fabricate things. And they were telling me, well, you know, we kind of have to do it ourselves. I was like, well, what do you mean? And then they told me that, you know, they had themselves wrote a report on Yemen, but because of the political situation and climate, they had to heavily redact it by fear of being held responsible, you know, by the leadership of some things that he might find, that Khamenei might find distasteful. There's a concerted effort to lie to him, not because they want to lie to him per se, but it's just because they're so scared that it would backfire on them.
So if they are kind of like what we know about Putin, like the reason why he misread the entire situation is because he's surrounded by a whole bunch of yes men, right?
Yeah.
Because people are afraid of, like,
sycophants. Yeah,
exactly. So and. It would be very believable that Khamenei is misreading the entire country because he's surrounded by a whole bunch of people that are scared of giving him, you know, real reports. especially because he has signaled so many times how much he rewards people who admire, like openly admire him, and people who like write poetries about him, or people who say nice things about him. They all of a sudden get higher rankings and more money and better positions. Mm-hmm. So when you put that as a signal out there, then you're telling people like, just make me happy with your words, and you will be rewarded accordingly. And that's very dangerous, because now people know, okay, so we shouldn't be telling you the truth. And that's what you're telling us, right? And that's why he might be mistreating the situation so badly. You know, this is why people in power get crazy so fast.
But it happens to on the media level. So the way that certain, like, for example, news is being curated in Iran across the state news agencies, they have journalists have to flat out lie. And I know some of them, so I know what they have to say. So let's just say, I give you an example, protest in Abadan. Okay, just as an example, I'm making this up. Okay, so this is, but so just to give you like an idea.
For people who don't know, Abadan is a city in Iran that recently there was a building collapse, and it has the whole province has been a center of a lot of protests against the regime. So yeah, go on. I just want to.
So let's just say, like, for example, somebody would write a report about Abadan and the collapse of that building. I don't know how many people died, but I think it's in the hundreds, if I'm not wrong. Isn't it?
I don't think so. No, but let me, I could look, but go ahead.
Maybe there was 300 people in the building, something, I'm not sure, I can't remember the figure. But let's just say, let's just assume there were 20 people dead, okay? 20 people is a lot. So they would say that they only could confirm, for example, 3 deaths as opposed to 20, okay? So the reality would be 20, they would say, no, 3. About the protests following the collapse 40, of the building.
41 so far.
Okay, so they would probably admit to only like a fraction of that, so maybe a third, to the leadership or in the news, saying it's a lot less because, you know, it would be too shocking. And then the protests that happened afterwards, let's say 200 people came out in the streets, in anger, they won't say 200, they would say 10. Or they would use words such as, angry protesters, backed by foreign powers. So they would keep like playing into this idea that it's never really Iranians coming out, that Iranians are very happy with the leadership. It's only people, it's always people who have, an ulterior motive and against the Islamic Republic and Iran as a country, that those people are traitors. It's really perversive the way they do things. So when you're surrounded all day, every day by sycophants that actually hide the truth from you, how do you want him to be taking any like meaningful decision? He doesn't know. He doesn't know. And I think he's too in love with himself and the power that he has that he doesn't want even to look.
So the one of the most recent theories that the pro-regime people are spreading around is that why would a building collapse in Abadan happen at the same time where the pro-regime people are planning a huge event in support of Khamenei and the regime? They're coming up with this conspiracy theory that this building, obviously the anti-regime people planned the collapse of this building to coincide with the celebration of the regime and Khamenei, especially given that the coincidences, it was at the same time and in a province where protests are picking up against the regime. So this cannot be an accident. This must have been a planned demolition of the building.
Well, look, you're laughing, but this is exactly how, but they probably believe that too.
Yeah.
Because they will believe it, because they say it explains everything. Because how could people could possibly be against us? You know, it's not like, they're hungry, they're being oppressed and repressed for 43 years, but why would they be angry at us, right? They don't even comprehend what is it that they're doing to their own people, because it's such a, I don't know, I think they live in an alternate reality. I truly do.
It's just so wacko that sometimes I listen to it and I think like, there's no way they believe this. They must be just like, they knowing that they're doing propaganda. Because I hear, for example, that they're saying like, Iranian people, like some of the mullahs that come on TV, they're like, this economic condition is nothing. Even if Iranian peoples die from starvation, they would rather die from starvation than seeing this regime go away. That's the kind of thing they would say. Like, this is like, this is not even the beginning of what the Iranian people are willing to tolerate to defend the regime. So this is the
and
kind
it's
of
ridiculous.
Narrative. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's ridiculous. Like, people, you know, most people, I don't care how politically, like, you know, literate anyone is, at the end of the day, when you, any, look, in any relationship that you engage with, whether politically or, you know, on a more personal level, once you reach, once the, whatever good you're getting out of it is being outweighed by the bad, you know, you need to take a decision. And I think that Iranians today realize that, forget ideology, forget religion, forget everything else, forget politics. This regime, this government is literally killing them. On a very, like, human level, this is not just like a metaphor. They're actually dying because of it. You know, they die if they oppose it. They can't find, you know, a job that is actually aligned with their qualification. You have people with, I don't know how many PhDs, who can't make ends meet because they can't find a proper job. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. You have, you know, Iran is a country where you have a lot of well-educated people who should be earning money, who should be, like, you know, I don't know, thriving. And it's not because of the regime, the way it's set up. It's stealing resources away from people. It's not even doing its job in terms of providing, like, basic amenities like water and electricity. In a country like Iran, this is insane. Like, no, you have, like, oodles of, like, natural resources and people don't have electricity. Like, how is that even happening?
Yeah, and they don't have food and electricity in the province that has the most oil. Like, they don't have water in the province that has the most water, and they don't have energy in the province that has the most energy.
Exactly. So it goes to show you that this is not a plot for foreign powers. You just have, like, profound mismanagement on a government level. So it has nothing to do with the people going against the, you know, the ideology. No, it's just, it's messed up. And you don't deserve to be there because Iranians are not getting a fair... whatever was promised to them by Khomeini in terms of you're going to have free bread, free houses, free whatever, it hasn't happened. They flat out lied. And people deserve a lot better than what they're getting right now.
Yep. But the problem is, like, some people suggest that there might be... that even as bad as the regime is, if you topple this regime, you might get absolute chaos and civil war for decades to come. And you might even have, as bad as things are, it's possible that it could get worse. Because imagine if the regime topples and we're like, oh my God, the regime is gone. Maybe secular democracy now, please. But then we're like, what do you think is going to happen to all the pro-regime people, plus Hezbollah, plus Hamas, plus the Fatimiyun in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. But the pro-regime people, based on studies, are 20% of the country, okay? So that's like 16 million people. Let's say 8 million people. Let's say half of that, okay? Out of these 8 million people, are 100,000 of them willing to die for this, to bring back Mehdi's regime back? Like, 100,000 of these 8 million, are they willing to do that? Because ISIS at its peak had 40,000 people. So 100,000 people that are actually have more resources than ISIS ever had, that were actually trained in actual battles and in wars, including the Iran-Iraq war, that is enough to paralyze an entire country. Mm-hmm. Like, especially a country that just lost a regime. So the fear is, like, would that be, like, how devastating that could be? Like, you could have a Shia version of ISIS centered in Iran trying to fight you against any form of secular democracy that you want to bring in power. Would they be able, like, wouldn't that mean, like, decades of, like, unrest? Especially also the secessionists would also be in power, like, at it, like, trying to get an independent Kurdistan, an independent Azerbaijan, an independent Khuzestan, an independent Baluchistan.
That's the fear. Yeah. Actually, like, and I got my hand bitten that day because I was actually trying to, I was on Clubhouse there. I talked to you about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I was on Clubhouse with friends and we were just literally having a conversation, actually trying to warn against the danger of, you know, a power vacuum. And also warning against the danger, because, you know, there's been murmurs about a war between Israel and Iran that would bring about like all of kind of nasty military, like, you know, dynamics, whereas, you know, we would have essentially a World War III type of thing. So we're not trying to be alarmist, but we're just like trying to look at what that would mean if there was, you know, like a real military confrontation. And what would that mean in terms of Iran's future? Because as you mentioned, there's a very, you know, the reality when you have either civil war or, you know, political instability or some kind of a constitutional crisis or war, is that the country on the receiving end of it, it would be Iran, usually ends up being partitioned. That's the reality in the Middle East. Look at Yemen. Yemen was a unified country. Now people are talking about one, two, three, maybe four Yemen. And essentially now you have North and South back. You know, if you look at Libya, for example, they can't agree on, you know, the color of the paper that they would write the new constitution on. The same thing with Iraq. There's a lot of problem with, you know, groups saying they want independence, they want this, they want that. It's problematic. So Iran, you know, could very well be in that situation. Now, it's a lot more dangerous when we talk about a country like Iran, because you have 80 something million people. You have a lot of different, like, you know, ethnic group that could suddenly get ideas and say, well, we want to break away, we want to do this. And it would become really problematic and so instability, like, for decades to come in a region of the world where you really need stability, you know, for many great reasons. And you're right, like, a lot of, and I think this is the reason why the international community has been so quiet in terms of its support of the protest, because they're thinking, okay, on the face of it, yes, of course, you know, if we could see a democratic Iran, a kind of like, you know, Western aligned Iran, great, that's what we want from the beginning. But the problem is that right now, in terms of the opposition groups, okay, and let's not talk even about the MEK, because they're just like, nah, it's like, it's a cult, so like, forget them. no, it's true, like, they're crazy people. Let's just, I'm sorry for like MEK lovers, but you guys are nuts. So like, no, we don't.
You should do an article on that one.
They are, I've done a couple. They are, it's just, it's vile. It's a terrorist group. And it's like a cultish, like, it's a cross between Scientology and like the Easter Bunny worship and crazy people. I don't like it. Anyway, so you don't really have a real kind of clear-cut opposition group that actually came out with a political program as such. Like, you don't even know, do you know the Republicans, for example? You know, you don't know, are you right, left, centrist, like, what is your program? We don't know. Then you have the monarchist. With the monarchist, it's a lot clearer, because you know exactly who they are, what they stand for. But they haven't had like this outreach program type of thing where, you know, they kind of like rallying the troops, because there's a lot of like, kind of like, we don't know. And then you have a lot of like, you know, you have like the Communist Party, this party, the whatever, and they're kind of insignificant on the face of it all. So I can see why the international community would be thinking, okay, so we have an opposition, we have opposition groups that really like no one has taken the lead. Okay, so we don't know what that would mean to support them, because we don't know really who they are and how people will respond to them in Iran. And then we have this regime that everybody hates. They're crazy, they're thieves and they're murderers, but we know them. So we know what they do. We can contain that, right? Now, I think, and look, I'm not a monarchist, because I'm French. I'm a Republican at heart, and I do believe in democracy. So it's kind of difficult for me to say this, but I'm trying to be pragmatic here and actually save people's lives, because ultimately people would die if there's insecurity in the region. Okay. Now, when Khomeini came up in 1979 and kicked the Shah out, he had to, you know, write a new constitution. Now, here's the thing. This new constitution is actually not technically valid, because 1906 constitution is very clear about the ways that you could go about either reforming it or even cancelling it out. So technically, legally speaking, from a constitutional standpoint, 1906 constitution could be recalled. That would mean that Reza Shah, who is the crown prince, or his mother, who is the queen regent, I don't know. Look, I don't know the technicalities of whether or not she's still queen regent, or whether the authority was clearly passed on to her son. I'm not sure. But those two people could very easily recall a government under that 1906 constitution. So it would be a government in exile, and actually use that to challenge the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic constitution and say that, you know, you are an imposter. You took over a state institution and you have no legal ground to do so, no legitimacy. You would then create essentially a constitutional crisis because the international community would have to pick a side and say, like, do we back Reza Shah and 1906 constitution, or do we back, you know, the Islamic Republic? I think it would be an interesting exercise, but think about this. That would mean that the people in Iran would actually have an alternative that would prevent for a power vacuum and that would allow for a return back to the way things were prior to the revolution, as far as the law and state institutions, you know, are concerned. So that would prevent, for, you know, like a complete kind of meltdown of state institutions. And also, which is interesting, because I actually read the constitution of 1906, under the constitution, all groups, I mean, regardless of ethnicity, religion, gender, whatever, are equal before the law. So that's a massive step up from 1979. And it allows for reform. So I'm not saying it's the best solution. I'm just saying that in terms of preventing a crisis of biblical proportion, it could be an argument that could be presented to the Iranians and the international community.
May I poke two holes at this
point? Go on. Poke away. Because look, this is like, you know, this is a theory. I don't know.
Yeah. For, the first two, first hole is that, what if they don't want to?
All right. Oh, what if neither the 100%. Look, like I said, it's a theory. I'm not saying do that. Yeah. I'm just saying it's, you know. Yeah.
I mean, if I had to guess, neither the Queen Regent or the Crown Prince would want to do that. They're like, we're like, we could be assassinated. Like, well, I mean, okay, yeah. So,
but look, it's not. I'm not saying that they have to or they want to. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, if you look at it, you know, and if you were to think, okay, what ways do we have right now, you know, that, to prevent a complete institutional meltdown and prevent a situation that we had, you know, where you could have something else coming into it, you know, rather than the Islamic Republic. And I'm thinking, I don't know, the alternative is here. I'm not saying it's a great one. I'm just saying it's there. And that maybe people need to think about it. That's all I'm saying. It's just like, it's an intellectual exercise. Just look at it this way. I'm not saying... Yeah. Let's call back the monarchy and let's do that. I don't have the solutions. Ultimately, people will have to decide. What I'm saying is that it's an interesting way of looking at things in my mind, because, you know, you have potentially an alternative to the violence that could, you know, ensue from a revolution, like a clear cut kind of revolution.
But here's my second problem, okay? Because it might not avoid any of that war, because the people who are not happy with this regime, they don't give two craps about the law. You know what I mean? They're like, we're fighting on the side of God. Like, you're like waving this constitution in front of my face. Like, I don't recognize your man-made laws. I am answerable to God and the
true.
Mentees. Yeah, yeah.
True, but here's the thing. Let's just assume, okay, again, theory, so because the people would, like, please don't jump me. In theory, let's just assume we go back to the 1906, you know, constitution. In theory, there's a government in exile, and then, you know, the leadership in Iran is being contested by the international community, okay? So let's just assume now that the international community takes the step of supporting and backing Reza Shah's claim to the throne, essentially, okay? That would mean that the regime is contained and challenged not only from within by the people in the street calling from their, you know, for their demise, and then also literally locked out of the international community. That means that they could lose, not only do they lose their privileges, like all the diplomats, everything would have to be called back. They lose everything. Diplomatic immunity will be gone. That's interesting for certain people.
That would require the United Nations to be willing do all of that.
But they
would
not.
They would not be willing.
I don't know. Because theory. Like, I'm just saying in theory, and then to answer your question, what that means is that the Islamic Republic would be locked out of the international community, and it would be so easy to just go and pick them, because you could say, listen, you get two options here. either you collaborate with us and then you might have safe passage to wherever and then keep some of your money, or we're coming to get you because they're coming for you anyway. So what do you want? I'm just saying that if everything was still lined up properly, you could avoid a catastrophe for Iranians and a bloodbath. That's all I'm saying.
But okay, so here's the question. If we can't avoid such a catastrophe, should we even be planning to topple the regime? Maybe the best thing is to be like, hey, this is horrible, but we have to deal with it. What do you think?
No,
like,
I tell you why. I tell you why. Because there's a clock on this regime by the nature of it. And the fact that they push it. Look at what they've been doing for the past, I would say, 3 months in terms of throwing tantrums because they can't revive the JCPOA. Nobody wants to delist the RSGC. They're not getting what they want. So what they have done, about 10 days ago, they hijacked a Greek tanker, you know, off the Persian Gulf. That's illegal. They're trying to blackmail Western powers. And Greece is a NATO member, by the way. So that means that, and that was an act of war. It could be considered as an act of war. They're playing with very dangerous military alliances in the world, and they're banking on the West's desire not to start a war, to keep poking and poking, you know, to get what they want, like a petulant child. You know, that can't carry on because we are in a situation, we are in an energy crisis right now. If they keep poking at the bear will come for them. And I'm not talking about Russia, I'm talking about NATO. They're playing with dangerous powers. They keep poking at Israel and they keep threatening to kidnap, you know, Israeli assets. They keep threatening to kidnap even Israeli, just flat out. They keep threatening all these different, like, revenge against the West and Israel. It's very dangerous. So you are facing basically a monster today who once upon a time used to be contained within its borders. But for the past 40 years, they have propped, financed and militarized, you know, terror groups. Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, all of them. Those are dangerous. The Houthis, you have countless, you know, iterations of terror under, you know, the umbrella of the Islamic Republic. How long can you keep it up? They're not containable anymore. So we're heading for a confrontation regardless. Now, would it be better to have the people do it in terms of, you know, take ownership of your country, get rid of those people? Or are we waiting for a military confrontation that would force military interventionism, that like what we've seen in Afghanistan and in Iraq? And we know what happens when that happens. Countries get chopped up. People die. It's horrible. And Iran would be a catastrophe for the next 20 years. Iraq is still not fine. I mean, look, they invaded in 2001?
Yes. Well, okay. Shortly, yes, yes. Shortly.
Yeah,
after.
I mean, they started, right? So, you know, 2020...
I think it was 1 year after, so maybe no.
Was it? Yeah, it was Afghanistan 2001, and I think Iraq 2003.
Oh, 2 years after.
Yeah, so there you go. But look, 20 years later, can we actually say that they have, like, you know, rebuilt their country? No, it's still a shit show. I mean, it's better because Saddam Hussein is not there, so to that extent, it's better. But there's still, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity and question mark over certain borders. I mean, people don't know whether they're coming or going. It's that constitution is a disgrace. It's not working. Afghanistan went backwards. It's even worse. Do you want to do that to Iran? I don't think so. So something's going to have to give. But those people are not staying. This is not happening. They can't because they're becoming way too belligerent.
I mean, if IRGC manages to take this whole thing away from the mullahs, they might be able to stay.
If they were to become like very classic, you know, military dictatorship style.
Military dictatorship, yeah.
Yes, but then they would have the issue of the clergy to deal with because it's still very ideological. So no.
I mean,
and the RSGC, no, because look, the RSGC is responsible, has taken the habit of, you know, telling Iraqis what to do, telling Yemeni what to do, Lebanese what to do, Syrian what to do. It's not working so well for them right now. Those countries are pushing back. So regardless of what happens, you're going to have clashes.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the IRGC is a lot more equipped to deal with that than the mullahs. And I mean, the mullahs might have their ideologies, but the IRGC has guns, so I don't know what they're going to do with their ideology.
They have their own kind of like the way that they see things. Again, they think that they have a mandate from God. It's just kind of a different type of mandate. It's a mixture of, religious ideology and military pragmatism. So it's kind of a very weird marriage that they have. But I don't think they're much better, to be honest with you.
Right. I do think you're right that things might move if the regime doesn't fall. Things are going to move towards the supreme leader being just a symbolic figure up there that you just point to say look, we are an Islamic theocracy and this is the Mahdi's regime and stuff, but it's just a symbolic figure and IRGC is doing everything. So I think that would be for keeping the regime, that is the most ideal thing to move towards, to strategically, right?
They'll try to do that.
Before I go to the live chat questions, I'm going to just ask maybe 5 live chat questions. I just want to ask this question. How likely, because a lot of people are asking it, how likely is it for Israel to go in confrontational, especially with this whole JCPOA and them trying to stop nuclear Iran, how likely it is for Israel to go into a direct confrontational head-to-head war with Iran?
Zero. They won't do it. Israel is not stupid. I'm just going to put it that way. So Israel has made very, very clear, and this is not me saying, this is Israel's government saying, not through me, okay? They've said it. I'm just saying because, they made clear that they would take out, nuclear sites and basically contain the threat that is the Islamic Republic to Israel. But they would not, they do not intend and do not want to declare war on Iran per se, as in a very kind of classic war, because they're not crazy. And also because they, number one, abide by international law, and number two, are very mindful of the cost in lives that it would entail. So they're not, Israel doesn't wage war, okay? They protect themselves and their interests, but they do not wage war. And they're not going to start tomorrow morning, regardless of what Iran says or does. It's not going to be like that.
Yeah, it would be very suicidal. I mean, as advanced as Israel is, the cost to Israel would be astronomical.
Exactly. No Israeli government will ever justify the loss of lives for the sake of war. They just wouldn't do it. They would do a defensive war, but they would never go to
Some people say if Iran is becoming nuclear, maybe a fair strike would be a defensive war. So that's what people would say. They did that with Iraq. Well, no,
sir, it wasn't an all-out war though.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
If it's strategic, it's kind of striking, where it's very contained, there's no civilian casualties as much as possible, obviously. And it's contained again. There's a clear military strategy and for an in and an out. Yes, maybe. But if it's just to say Bush did, let's go to war against Afghanistan. We don't know how long. We don't know what we're gonna do. We don't know how and how we're gonna come out of it. No, Israel will never do that.
Yeah. Okay, let me do the live chat questions because I don't want to hold you up for too long. Ayan is saying, if Iranian regime falls, will this leave a precedent for other Islamic countries to become secular?
I like that question. It's a very good question. There's definitely an opportunity because if, for example, the next constitution or the next government would be secular, which in my mind would be the best way to go. Iran could become, a model for the rest of the world. And I think there would be an irony there. but I think it's definitely possible because Iranians, unlike many of the other, countries in the region, and I'm not passing judgment, are a lot more educated. And I think they have they're better equipped to actually exercise democracy and understanding secularism. So definitely a possibility.
Okay, so Dee is asking if IRGC has a leader. The IRGC leader is not that
There's a commander. You have a commander, but he answers to the leadership, as in Khamenei. So and he could be changed like that. So he
and
does
he's
as well.
chosen, but
yeah, he's
he's
chosen
chosen.
By the
Yeah, but the thing is, that's very interesting because Qasem Soleimani, who wasn't the leader of IRGC, he was the leader of the Quds.
He was the commander. Yeah.
Of course, like so, the commander of like so, the IRGC has five things, right? So they have air force, a navy, a ground force, the Basij, and Quds. So Qasem Soleimani was the leader of one of these five parts of IRGC, and he was more powerful and more famous than the leader of IRGC, arguably some people say more than Khamenei himself, like more popular than Khamenei himself, right? So the leader
Actually,
of
yeah.
IRGC, yeah. So the
which
leader,
is maybe why, I'm just saying, maybe that's why. It was a bit too popular for some people's liking.
Yeah, some people say that maybe, like, yeah, he was, Qasem Soleimani was given away by, like, people in the Iranian regime, hardliners were happy that he died because he was a competition to a lot of people, right?
Well, yeah, think about it this way. Look, for someone like Soleimani to be asked to go to Iraq, because he didn't go on a holiday, he was asked to go. So that means that intelligence were in charge of his travel plans. They knew exactly where he was going to be, with whom, all this. Someone like Soleimani doesn't just get taken out without some kind of intelligence sharing.
I mean,
I'm just saying.
He had, I don't know, actually, because he had his phone. So if he, I mean, that's easy. It's easy to track where you are if you have your
phone.
Well,
no, it's just, look, when the second he entered, you know, Iraqi's airspace, Iraq's intelligence services took over. And they have protocols with Iran. So they knew exactly where he was. I know that to be a fact, by the way. They knew exactly where he was. And they had a window. They had a window of opportunity where they could have stopped it, and they didn't. They chose not to. So I'm just saying.
Okay, well, I don't know.
Because like
I
you said, he had his phone. So they could have called him and said, hey, get out. They didn't.
But did they know that they were going to be attacked? I mean, they shot down their own plane. These are people who shut down their own plane. So how?
Yeah, but they knew he was set up. They knew he was going to be killed. They knew who was going to be in the car with him, and they chose not to stop it for whatever reason. But they chose to. It was a concerted effort. Trump may have pulled the trigger, but there's a lot of guilt sharing in that process.
PK saying, how should the West deal with Iran? What is Iran's relations with? Okay, these are two very big questions. But let's just do one of them. How should the West deal with Iran?
I can do two. Look, Iran's relation with China has literally bought out Iran. They're playing they have tremendous, financial influence and commercial influence. Everything, they have massive projects in Iran. They're controlling a lot of, energy markets and things like that. So it's quite interesting. A lot of the oil, for example, the sanctioned oil is going to private refineries in China called Teapot Refinery. Look it up. It's actually quite interesting. They're making billions from sanctioned oil and with no international oversight whatsoever. It's quite interesting. I would say they're treating Iran like their little backyard in terms of, making money, transactions, banking, things like that. How should the West deal with Iran? The one thing I'm going to say, because I don't have a solution, okay? So I'm not, the only criticism I have of the West is I believe that we should be looking towards finding a better way. I'm not saying I have one, okay? But I think we have to always refer to international law. And as far as I'm concerned, Iran is breaking every single, law that exists in terms of, human rights and, violating other countries' sovereignty, and the list goes on and on and on. We should not pay lip service to they're crazy. We should not be foolish enough to think that we could contain it, because I don't think that we can. We're pushing the problem further down the line, and the problem is getting a lot bigger. So that means that it's going to take tremendous effort for us to deal with it. I think we should hold them accountable systematically for what they do, and have more targeted sanctions. So not, hurt the people, but hurt the people responsible for certain decisions. Basically take them out one at a time, and just to not entertain the crazy. They have no, they can't occupy space. It's 2022. you can't be screaming God and actually ask, you know, international powers to say like, yeah, it's okay. We want to sit at the table with you. I'm sorry, but you don't get to sit at the table. I just want you out. You just don't exist for me. So differently, I would say.
I want to also mention, like, you're right about how Chinese government is taking advantage of Iran right now because of the regime being so isolated with the, you know, a lot of Western countries. They're like getting closer to Russia and China, and China is using their desperation to get a lot of deals that is not within the best interest of the Iranian people. And they should be called out for that. However, I'm also worried about, because in Iran, there's a lot of racism, and I just, like, on, you know, on Persian Clubhouse, what I try to do, and also on the Persian channel, is to not, I don't just fight Islam, I also fight racism, because that's something that is very common among Iranians. I mean, it's common in many places, including Iran. And I'm expecting that maybe some anti-Chinese racism is about to rise in Iran because of how close the Islamic Republic of Iran is to the CCP. So I just want to, like, I did that with Russia, for example. A lot of Iranians were becoming anti-Russian, and I like made a show trying to be like, hey, this is a Putin thing, this is not a Russian thing, like, look, please not hold the entire Russian people collectively responsible. So I'm guessing that eventually I have to do something in defense of the Chinese people, like, this is a CCP thing, not a Chinese people thing, because there's a lot
before
of that.
Before you do that, we should do a room to invite, you know, Israelis and, you know, Jews in general to yes. chat with Iranians, because first of all, there's a massive, you know, Iranian Jewish community in Israel. That's one. Yeah. But I think it would be cool because whenever I had conversation with the, you know, with both sides, it's amazing. Like, people actually have a lot more in common, and, you know, they found out that they it's okay to be friends. It's actually, you don't, you know, it's possible. And I think it's important.
Yeah.
And you're the only one I know who speaks Farsi properly, so it's your job.
Okay. No, I would love to do that. I love this project. And, you know, a lot of people in Iran don't even understand that there's, like, when we're talking about Jewish, we could be referring to three different things. We could be referring to a religion, we could be referring to an ethnicity, or we could be referring to a culture. And these three things are not always the same thing. So that's, like, people just jump from one to another.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, look, ultimately, you know, people are people. And I think it's important to have, like, a dialogue and to, we don't all have to sing Kumbaya, but at least to learn how to respect one another's differences. It's a good way to start.
Yeah. Okay, here's the last question. Terrell is asking this question. It says, for Catherine, does 1906 Constitution say what happens if the Pahlavi dynasty dies out? In my country, Denmark's Constitution, the throne goes to the next collateral line.
That's a really good question, and I don't know, if I'm honest with you, because, look, it was, you know, my thinking into this as being an option, which is started about 2-3 weeks ago, where I started, because I was just trying to think outside the box and thinking, is there a way, you know, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. Is there something that we could use that exists already that we could build upon to try to introduce, like, a smooth transition as much as possible? So I looked into the 1906 Constitution, but I haven't looked in enough details, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer. So I think that maybe you should invite someone who knows about the law a lot more than I do to have that conversation. I don't know. I genuinely don't know. But I would imagine that there's a provision somewhere, because, I mean, especially when you have a monarchy, you need to think about lineage. So I would assume, you know, but look, the dynasty is not dying out, because Reza Shah, the crown prince, has daughters. I think he has two or three.
Catherine, they don't even speak Persian that well. So I don't know if that's possible.
I don't know. But I mean, look, there's always family members. It's still a big family. So
yeah, it's a big family. Actually, you're right. There's a whole bunch of other people that are political as well.
So even if it's not Reza Shah, like I said, even, like, you know, you were telling me earlier, what if he doesn't want it? Well, let's just assume 1906 is recalled, whatever. I mean, he could always, like, kind of say, I'm going to pass on the buck to blah, blah, blah. Yeah. me, for example. I'm just kidding.
So is saying they can learn. I mean, they're not very, they don't seem very eager. So they've met the opposition and they're like, these people are crazy and we want to stay away. Thank you very much. I don't know. I think that's my impression of that entire family. I might be wrong. I don't know. I just want to tell everybody to make sure that they go and read your article on Times of Israel. The article is called "Are the Men's Regime in Iran Planning to Overthrow the Leadership?" Go check this out. It was a really quick read, but it was, it had some very interesting parts that a lot of people might not be aware of, because a lot of people just assume like, oh, all mullahs, religious crazies, they're all the same. But there's a lot more to it than that. And this is like a good introduction for you to see how the hardliners, the different groups, and how they're turning on each other, and the different, it's a Game of Thrones, basically, kind of happening.
It is. Yeah. That's the thing. And people I don't understand why not more people are looking at Iran from different angles and actually, having those discussions, because it's always very, I don't know, they oversimplify Iran. They don't give it like all the textures that it has. It's a complicated place, and it's just like, I don't know.
I am saying maybe Armin Kendrell.
I think it would be a lot. He's a better option than I ever could be, because I'm not Iranian at all. So, and I don't speak the language either. So.
I would like to live. Thank you very much, Cheyenne.
No, I think you would do. Like, you could be like a cross between a king and a president.
Yeah, and get assassinated on the fifth day of my job.
No, you wouldn't.
Yeah, okay. Oh, wait. So Ibn Khiyam is also saying Catherine's idea of backing a monarchy will lead to another revolution 30 to 50 years down their line. I don't think so.
I'm not backing the monarchy. That's the thing I'm trying to explain. I'm just offering an alternative that would allow for reforms to take place in a more democratic way, because the Islamic revolution is like, blech, okay? It's just not happening. The constitution of 1979 is garbage. It needs to be thrown out in the trash and never to be revisited ever again. All I'm saying is that the 1906 constitution is not half bad, and it makes room for reform. So I thought, and it's just a theory, it could be a good platform to introduce democratic reform and actually put it up to the people to decide what they want. A republic, a parliamentary monarchy, whatever it is. But I think it would be a good basis. That's all I'm saying. It's a good, kind of like step one.
I agree that if there's a toppling of the regime, there's not going to be an election on day one, right? There's not going to be a government. Yeah. So there needs to be something. But the problem is that if it has a monarchist brand, then it might, because of the definition of monarchy, it might become not a transitionary government to something democratic, and has a danger of just staying there forever. So that's a problem with the branding of
it. I understand it. I'm just saying, like I said, my theory is not a perfect one. I'm just saying it's just an intellectual exercise that I find interesting and like to discuss it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not making an argument for the monarchy or anything. I'm a Republican, hardcore. So don't it's just an idea.
Okay, this is a last comment. It's not a question. It says Terrell is saying Armin. Say Armin just asked the Mossad for protection. They have the IRGC, so they would know how to keep you safe.
I know, and your dream could come true. You could get hooked up. That's it.
Yeah, put me in touch, Catherine, please.
Yeah, first me.
Guys, please make sure, this is like, it's really valuable information for Catherine, so please make sure you like this video and also share this with as many people as you can. And also, Catherine and I have some really incredible projects coming up that we can't talk about, so make sure you stay tuned, so we're going to announce them. And also, we're going to be active on the Persian side as well, so we have so many plans. Okay, so
If you guys go on Clubhouse, if you want a message, if you have ideas of things that we should do or questions that you want us to talk about, just seriously, you can find me on Instagram, on Twitter, Clubhouse, obviously. I'm open to suggestions or whatever. So if you have ideas or things that you want to see happen, let me know.
Okay, and they would just search for your name, Catherine Shakdam.
If you go on my Twitter, it's @ShakdamC, Clubhouse is obviously my name. Instagram is Catherine Chagdam, one word. You can find me and just, yeah, drop me a line and tell me that, you know, I don't know, if you have questions, whatever it is.
Okay. All right, guys. All right, so do that, guys. And also check out the article that she wrote. And yeah, so see you guys soon. We're going to have more episodes with Catherine Chagdam coming up very soon. All right, guys. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thank you.